Accession number 32297, reel 24.
John Dixon, reel 24. Right, so we've got past that, and then eventually, as I say, the currency came back and things became reasonably more normal. One of the first things that we did when we got to Hong Kong, my mother had got a girlfriend from her school days who had married a British chap and lived in Hong Kong. I think he was in the Hong Kong police. Anyway, they lived out there, and we knew that that they'd all been interned by the Japanese, and the ladies were all interned at a place called Stanley Camp, which was right out on the western end of Hong Kong Island. And I knew that this good friend of my mum's, I knew she'd got twin daughters, June and Maureen, and I knew they were my age. And so I thought, well, this could be promising, you see. So I thought, well, how do I get out to Stanley Camp? And there was one of our observers, Pete Stansfeld. He'd also got some reason to go there, I don't remember what. And we couldn't work out how we were going to get there. But our ship's pilot, when I say pilot, I mean the navigating officer of the ship, not an aviator. The ship's pilot was a chap with a big black beard. He looked like a pirate. He was Lieutenant Commander Wyatt, RN. And he had been stationed in Hong Kong at the time of the Japanese invasion, and he was living there with his wife, and he got away, but his wife didn't, and he knew that she was also out in Stanley Camp. So he, being a lieutenant commander, had somehow or other commandeered some form of transport. I don't know what it was now. But he was on his way to go and rescue his wife. And so we tagged along. And yes, I met this good lady and the two daughters, who were very charming and very attractive. And I thought, well, I might be looking for a bit of company. But no. We quickly realised that the old social strata in Hong Kong, it never died. And the junior sub-lieutenants were not quite of the right sort of level to entertain these two young ladies, who were very nice, extremely polite, and we did go. I think we saw what they were doing. They'd set up a school. They'd got a church. They'd got some sort of social life going. We did go down, and I remember we went swimming with them in the bay. Just a quick couple of stories on this one. I'm on this topic. The Japanese always insisted on these ladies that there were never any Red Cross parcels. Never. They didn't arrive any Red Cross parcels. They survived, these people. But the ladies always killed themselves with laughter, because the Japanese soldiers were often made to work out on the roads and things, and it was hot and it was dusty and the dust was flying everywhere, so they put masks on their faces to protect. And what were the masks? They were ladies' sanitary items, which could only have come in the Red Cross parcels. The rest of the parcels never got beyond the Japanese. So that was one little story we were told, and I quite believe it. I'm sure they wouldn't have told us things like that. The other thing was, I think we had a couple of three trips out to Stanley, and we'd been swimming with these girls on one occasion, and we'd come off the beach and we didn't see it, but there was one of our British chaps, and not one of our troops, but a British civilian who had been interned and was released, and he'd been 4 years in a prison camp, and he was swimming there after we'd left, thank God, and he was just swallowed by a shark, it was horrific. Because we didn't know too much about sharks. We certainly didn't go swimming anymore. But you think of this poor chap, 4 years in a camp, and then he's eaten by a shark. Oh dear. So that was that. Anyway, these two girls, they only a couple of weeks after that, they all sailed home on a ship called the Highland Monarch, and I can remember we went and waved them off, but there we are. So they came back to the UK on the Highland Monarch. What we'd also discovered was that these two girls, they'd got English fiancés who were interned in a different camp. Some of them weren't probably even in Hong Kong. And they'd been separated, but they had heard that their two lads had survived, so that was the end of it. We were surplus to retirement requirements, I think you could put it that way.
So was it changing as you were there? Mm-hmm. Was the bit of life coming back to Hong Kong?
Well, yeah, it took a long time. We were then given jobs. There's no longer sort of question of sculling about. Everybody was given a job, and our troops, the sailors, they were all sort of split up into what their different skills were, and they found work. It may have been in the power stations, the waterworks, or all the utilities, and getting the trams and things back. The Star Ferry, which ran backwards and forwards across, I don't say our people, but they got that back running. Everybody was given jobs. And of course the Marines and some of them, they formed like police patrols. A lot of our officers, young lads, were put in charge of these patrols, which basically became like military police. Trying to establish law and order, which we did very quickly. They were all quite keen to get back to normality, but it took time. The other thing that happened, I mentioned Lieutenant Commander Wyatt. Now, before the war, he had been a staunch member of the Royal Hong Kong Yacht Club, which, of course, was a social hub of what went on in Hong Kong. And the yacht club was not exactly derelict, but it was very battered about. And so he took a crowd of our sailors and they restored it. They worked on this place and brought it back to life. And even today, there is I've not seen it, but there's a plaque in the Royal Hong Kong Yacht Club which says this was restored by personnel from HMS Vengeance in 1945, which is a nice thing to know it's there. But that was a priority to get the yacht club going. The other thing was there was the Hong Kong dairy, but there were no cows, so we don't know what happened to them. There was a distillery, nobody had any. The only booze that was available in Hong Kong was the Japanese had been brewing some sort of brandy. It was called Tiger's Breath or something. It was neat alcohol. And very, very quickly our medics said, don't touch it, it's lethal. And if you drank it, it was liable to turn you blind. But that may have been propaganda to stop the lads getting at it, because it really was vicious sort of stuff. So These were the jobs that people thought they ought to get the colony back on its feet. Let's get the distillery going, let's get the dairy farm going, and the yacht club.
What about you? What were you doing?
Well, Bill Williams, who had then become my observer, he and I were given the job of taking over a warehouse on the Kowloon side. Out there, you don't call them warehouses, they're called go-downs. And this was a British naval go-down. Our brief, it was just Bill and I, and we were told that we had to, the officer in charge of this go-down was a certain Captain Tilly, RNVR, who was probably had been a civilian, but was given a naval rank. Now, he was nowhere around. Nobody knew where he was. But until he came back and took over, Bill and I were told we had to go to this warehouse. We had to clear out all the Japanese equipment that was in there and make sure that it was clear and ready for us to bring British naval supplies back in. So you walk into a warehouse and you see it's stacked up with all sorts of, well, how do you get rid of this lot? What were we going to do? The only brief we had was that any war material, any arms or anything to do with the forces, had to be handed over to the Chinese nationalists, who were supposedly on our side. They were supposed to be our allies, but it was a complete shambles, but that's another story. But the nationalists had any war material. Anything else was up to us. We could do what we like with it, within reason. Well, we didn't know how to go about this. Anyway, the first morning we were there, there was a sort of, not exactly a knock on the door, but this, what looked like a very ancient Chinese coolie chap appeared. When I say ancient, he was probably no more than 45 or 50, but he looked ancient. He had walked from Canton, which can't remember how far away, it was more than 100 miles, I think. He'd walked. And he proved it by a pass he had with his photograph. He was the storekeeper in this warehouse when the Japs came. And he had taken his family to Canton. They'd all scarpered off to Hong Kong, to Canton, when the Japs came into Hong Kong. He just wanted his job back. So he came along. And the brilliant thing was he spoke English, quite good English. So he explained to us who he was, and he got this pass. And please, could he have his job back? So we said, well, we'd love to have you, but we can't pay you because we haven't got any way of paying you. So he didn't, no, that's fine. Mate. So he was, well, I'll start now. So we said, well, we need some hands to, have all this fixed. Within a couple of hours, we had 41 coolies working for us. They must have all been his brothers or cousins or brothers-in-law. But they all came and they were going to work for us. And they did work for us. They were absolutely brilliant. How were we to know them? Well, within half a day, they'd made little armbands with Royal Navy sort of stenciled on. So every one of our coolies had one of these armbands, which we gave them when they turned up for work in the morning. We were able to pay them because in the warehouse, believe it or not, the Japanese had left some rice. Not a lot, but there was enough rice. And I don't know whether we worked it out or whether we were told by somebody, but the payment for a day's work was 3 catty. I don't know what a catty is, a catty of rice. 3 catties of rice, which basically was 3 cupfuls, and that was what they were delighted to work for, that because that at least kept them and their perhaps helped their families a little bit. But that's what they were paid, and our job was to clear out all this warehouse. When the currency came in, we were allowed to pay them. Was that $1 a day? Oh, I don't remember. Anyway, quite a small amount. It was a Hong Kong dollar was then worth about 1 3 or 7.5p in today's money. But that's what they were paid, and they were delighted that they could have something like that. In this warehouse, there was reams of blue denim, which is what the coolies wear, you know, that's their normal dress. We had to get rid of it. So, number one boy, our lad, "Don't worry, master, don't worry, get rid of it." So we said, "All right, well, it wasn't war material, it could go." So, the next morning, about 10 sampans, you know, these little rowing boats, they all arrived in this little, because there was a little dock outside this warehouse, and they all arrived, these 10, and this denim went just like that. It disappeared. They all went. And it went to a gentleman called Chan Tuck, who was a tailor, and he worked on Hong Kong Island, and this went. We got a chit. We got the chit for all this time, and we carefully filed that away, the chit. Within 2 weeks, Bill and I had got beautiful navy blue blazers, grey flannel trousers, with a little label inside, Taylor Chan Tuck. But it was all right, wasn't it? I didn't think we did anything wrong. We were only doing our job. Now, any war material had to go to the Nationalists, as I told you, and we found, well, I don't say found, but it was in the warehouse, this huge motorbike and a sidecar. It was more than a normal size motorbike. I don't know about motorbikes, but some of the lads said it was sort of like a Harley Davidson. Great thing. Anyway, we quickly painted it in battleship grey. You know, it was painted battleship grey. The number plate, we put 812 Squadron on it. So that was not going to the Nationalists. So it was wheeled out onto the jetty. We thought, well, how does it go? Because it had got a hand gear lever. I mean, I don't know about motorbikes, but normally you change gear with your foot, don't you? But this was a hand gear lever. But it didn't seem to have any clutch. We didn't know how did you get it into... Anyway, two of the Corsair pilots who was working nearby, "Don't worry, we know all about motorbikes. We'll deal with this." So could they have first go on it, you see? So we said, well, all right, if you can make it go... So we put 100 octane petrol in it, which we must have brought off the ship, I suppose, and we stood it on this jetty, and there was a chap called Tony Raquel, who sadly lost his life in the post-war years, and a chap called Rouse, I think it was Lofty Rouse. They climbed on this thing, and they got it going, how to make it move. So they selected some sort of gear, and they must have discovered that the clutch was on the handle. They let the clutch in, and it shot backwards. Now, I don't know, but I'm told motorbikes don't have reverse gears, but this did. and it shot backwards, and how it didn't go over the edge of the jetty, nobody knows, but they'd worked it out. Anyway, we stopped it. That motorbike became part of our squadron, and we kept it, and we got it back on board when we left Hong Kong, and it eventually ended its days when we got back to Ceylon. You could get 7 people on it. You could get the driver and somebody on the pillion seat. You could get somebody sitting in front of the driver, which didn't make his view very good, but and then you could get 4 people in the sidecar, sort of sitting on one another's laps. And it was brilliant because, you know, where else was there any transport?
So is there anything more with the warehouse?
No, eventually, we did get it clear, and I think we got it all tidied up. By that time, we heard that Captain Tilly, the big boss man, had arrived from wherever, we don't know. Bill and I were sort of hanging around waiting for him to come and take over. But he seemed as if he'd got lots of friends he wanted to go and visit before he was ready to come and start work. But he did come eventually towards the end of September. He was very, very pleased with what we'd done. We handed all these chits over that we'd got, and he said, well, there you are, that's what's happened to the stuff. It presumably came back into operation, and I take it number one boy kept his job. What was quite interesting, in the back of the warehouse, I can remember it now, there were lots of our British sailor suits, white duck uniforms that they used to wear before the war, very pucker, and white caps and ship's ribbons, you know, that went ship's name ribbons that went on their cap. And I can always remember HMS Eagle. Now, she was one of our aircraft carriers, and she'd spent the interwar years, or a lot of them, on the China station, and it was obviously a life of Riley out there. There were some of her cap ribbons. Sadly, she was sunk in the Mediterranean in 1942. But I just remember this. Oh, the other thing, that there were some lovely little box, which I've got in the other room here now, little box containing Japanese aviators' goggles, with Japanese writing on them. I thought, well, I think I could have one of those, just keep, you know, as a souvenir. I'd said, worked out in my little mind that if they were going to be issued to a Japanese pilot, he was probably going to be a kamikaze lad, so the goggles would have been written off anyway. So I've still got those. But other than that, I think that was the end of the episode. Oh, yeah, the other, I don't know how much tape we've got left on here. The drill was that Bill and I, we lived on board the ship, which was anchored in the harbour. Every morning we'd have a jolly good breakfast on board. The warrant officer, who was in charge of the wardroom pantry, he'd give us a lot of corned beef sandwiches, lovely corned beef. He'd pack those up for us, and we'd go ashore and we'd do our job in the warehouse or whatever we had to do. And then at a certain time, probably about 5:30 in the evening, we'd go back to the jetty, and the ship's boat would come and take us back on board, where we'd change, have a shower and have dinner, and that was it. It was a very civilised existence. One day, we'd done our stint in the warehouse, we came back to get the ship's boat, there was no ship's boat. And when we looked, there was no ship either. She'd gone. And so had all the other big ships. There'd been a typhoon warning. And so the drill was that the big ships who were anchored, they all picked up their anchors and they went out, off out to sea, just to ride out the storm, which was the safest thing to do. Which was all very well, but nobody had thought that Bill and I were sort of trapped ashore. So we were sort of standing there, well, what do we do now, you see? And along came this chap who was a lieutenant in the, he was a paratroop officer. And they'd just come in from Burma, these paratroops. And he sort of looked at us and said, what's up? So we said, well, we got nowhere to go. We've lost our ship, you see. Oh, he said, don't worry about that. Come back with me to my mess. And he said, you can have a bed there for the night. So back we went to his mess. And he was a very generous host. He kept us in that there overnight, gave us breakfast. I think he lent me his razor in the morning. Bill didn't need a razor because he'd got a beard. Anyway, he was absolutely, he couldn't have been nicer. His name was Don Cawley, Cawley. And there's a bit more to tell you about him later on, but he was so anxious to help that he said, well, why don't you come and live here permanently in my mess? It'll save you all this backwards and forwards to the ship, which is exactly what we did. We packed up our best white uniforms and everything we needed, and we moved into his mess, and we lived with him for, you know, another 2 or 3 weeks. Don Cawley became he'd met a very charming white Russian lady there called Olga, and the white Russians were, as you know, they'd come from Russia at the time of the revolution, and she came from quite a well-to-do family. Anyway, he'd met her, very tall lady, if I remember, she was taller than Don. And eventually, many, many, many months later, they were married. And their son, Roger, married Yvonne Goolagong, the Wimbledon ladies' champion. So she is now Yvonne Cawley, and that's just a little side story for you.